I'm Gordon Van Amberg, and this workshop is How to Recruit. Okay, to start the discussion this afternoon, I'd like to interact with you through the whole thing, because the things that you have to contribute are as important as to what I have to contribute. The only difference is that I've had a little longer to think about it, and perhaps to worry a little bit, too. So to begin, let's start with a definition of recruiting. What does it mean to recruit? Or what is recruiting? To recruit is to what?
To influence a person to commitment.
Okay, good. To influence a person to commitment. Okay, that'd be a good way to describe it. How else would you describe it? Good, good, Bo. To attract a person to what you're doing. Okay, how else? You're going to buy that one, huh? Okay. Okay, any other words? How about in the military context? To recruit is to?
Enlist.
That's a good synonym. To recruit is to enlist. Okay, I say another way to describe it is to engage persons for service, or to enroll another in support of your vision. So we might say to recruit is to enlist, to engage, to enroll. Now when we say the word recruit, many of us form a mental picture of what happens, of a process. And if you have a military background, then the word recruit has a military connotation. And if you don't, may have another connotation. When you think of someone being recruited to the military, what process do you see in your mind? What happens? Just describe it. Draft. Against your will.
Services as they compete together for people. Mm-hmm. They have to accrue a series of benefits, win one, win you over to their point of view. A decision.
Okay, there's a decision involved.
Make a decision.
Yeah, sure is.
Tell you how good it is.
Okay, they tell you how good it is. And how good it they say it is, does that necessarily mean that that's how good it is? Now, take the Marine Corps, for example. Safe ground. Okay, well, see, there's a Marine tanker back there. Okay, so if the Marine Corps projects an image, right? And they dress it up, and they say, that's a Marine. And if you're good enough, maybe you fit in. And so people look at that and they become all excited about it because everybody, not everybody, but those that the Marines want to be a part of the elite. And so the person is recruited against the image that's projected. Now, if the image was accurate and the person is fulfilled in it, will he usually re-enlist? Yeah, generally so. But what if the image was false? And it comes to sign your name for the next 4 years? No, he'll leave the system, won't he? Okay, that's a little bit about how little visualization of recruiting. But the point of the whole thing is this. In recruiting, a man to the military, a man is plucked up out of his familiar civilian environment, taken through a process of pledges and paper signing and all the rest of it, and plunked down into a brand new environment that is different, strange, and frightening. And I think many of us have this same concept in our mind when we think of recruiting. And for some of us, it shades our concept of ministry. Perhaps we feel that we need to pluck someone up out of his environment and drop him wholly into the navigator environment before he's recruited and before we can effectively work with him. So with that as kind of a background, let's get into recruiting. I'd like to begin with five levels of recruiting that have been very helpful to me. Now, these levels of recruiting could be defined and stated in different terms, but just for the sake of our common discussion, I'll use these. The first level of recruiting, or the level to which we recruit a person, is salvation. Perhaps you've not thought of that in those terms before. The next level to which we recruit a person is lordship. The third level is to vision. The fourth level is to the team. And Jack used the terms, you might make a distinction between ministry team and hardcore team. But nonetheless, it's to the team. The fifth level is the organization, the navigators. One of the beauties of these levels of recruiting is this, and its usefulness is that you never want to recruit someone to your team that you have not first recruited through salvation, lordship, and vision. I mean, let's not recruit a man to our team who has not yet received Christ as his Savior. Let's not recruit a man to our team who does not have Christ at the center of his life. And let's not recruit a man to our team who does not understand and have an identification with our vision. And let's not impart vision to a man who is not yet converted. And let's not work on vision until Christ is somewhere near the center of his life. So we want to recruit to these levels in order. And in that way we can have a healthy ministry and keep people in perspective as to where they are and how they're doing in the recruiting process. Now, of the first three, and I just lumped the first three together because they're somewhat related to recruiting a person to salvation, to lordship, and to vision. How much loyalty would you demand from a person in order to work with him at those three levels? Well, I'll state it another way. How much authority would you feel that you had to exercise over a person before you would be willing to work with him in leading him to the Lord, in helping him with a Christ-centered life and imparting vision to him? And I'd like your comments. Pardon me?
How much authority?
Yeah, how much authority would you want to exercise, or how much loyalty would you demand from him? And I'm not necessarily saying it's the same at each level, but it's related.
One of the things that impressed me with last night's message was that Walt said influence and authority has to do related to relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so it depends on my relationship with that individual. You know, how am I related to him? Do I have a real heart tie with that person? And then I can influence and exercise the authority.
Okay, let's say in the process of salvation, what would you demand from a person in return to lead him to the Lord? Okay?
Nothing.
Nothing long range, would you? Certainly you would demand short range commitment, wouldn't you? 30 minutes of listening?
No, very short range.
Short range, okay, but nothing long range, okay? How about the lordship? Let's take as an illustration, as an example, a person who, let's take 6 months to 9 months before a person moves to putting Christ at the center of his life. Okay, now you think in your mind how you'd want a relationship defined with that person before you'd work with him. How much authority? How much loyalty?
Friendship.
Just friendship.
Yeah.
some time.
Okay. The thing I would be interested in is his interest. Is he really interested in finding out about lordship? If he's interested, I don't care whether, you know, we were good friends or what, I would still share with him and try to help him learn if he's really interested in making Christ Lord.
Right?
It seems like he'd have to have confidence in me as someone who can tell him what God wants from him. In other words, he has to see, he has to have the Word of God as an authority to a certain degree before he'll believe in it. He has to believe that I can give him an accurate interpretation of what God expects of him.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, as you were talking about what we would demand from a person, I don't think we're going to give any, we're not going to tell him a certain number of standards in this. We're not going to sit down and say, I expect this from you necessarily. We're going to ask him if he wants to spend an hour of week in Bible study and so forth, but we're not going to tell him that this is the conditions necessary.
Okay. Y'all pretty well concur with that? That you can safely, you could leave that man in his current environment, relate to him effectively, and bring Christ to the center of his life. He's not required to lift him out of what he's doing and plunk him into our environment exclusively. Would you?
It's under his terms.
It's under, perhaps under his terms. And you might be able to do that without that person being in your Bible study or anything else. Or it may be that you'd want that guy to commit himself to 10 weeks of Bible study or to whatever, but it's just for the sake of helping him, that man, in his own personal relationship with the Lord. Yes?
You're following him up, it seems like, to the degree that he wants to be followed up.
Okay. Yeah. Now, would you be willing to do that? Well, some of the NAV ministries that I've seen around, not all navigators are willing to do that. There are some ministries that are run rather tightly, and that before a man can be worked with, he has to make some kind of a long-range commitment, and loyalty is demanded, where if you want help in a Christ-centered life, then you better check in before you go home this weekend. You heard of those kind of things? Okay.
I think the only thing there that would cause a real problem would be how much time you have to invest in just everyone who's interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe you are starting a new ministry and you have a few guys that are really willing to commit themselves to the long haul. So maybe you have to demand a little bit more because of the number of people that you can work with.
But at that level, would you want anyone to commit himself to the long haul?
No, I don't think. I think you just either have to decide, well, either you can work with him or you can't. You know, you can't.
Okay, what if at that level some guy said, boy, I'm with you forever?
Well, he makes the commitment for himself when he says that.
Would you encourage him?
But I'm not sure I'd want him.
Oh, amen. Neither am I. Because a guy that do that, there's something wrong with him. You know, if he could go this far in life and not have anything to do, then something must be wrong. So I would, wait a minute. Now I'll help you with this, and let's just leave it at that. Now he may want to jump right on the team, and based on eagerness and enthusiasm and bubbles produced per minute, you would say, man, let's get him on the team. Well, wait a minute, you know, there's some steps that are missing. Let's take him through it and see what comes out.
When you're talking about commitment too, like lordship, a lot of that doesn't have to be done on this one-to-one commitment level.
Mm-hmm.
If he has a respect or like Roy mentioned, confidence in you, he can be in a group situation without necessitating any further commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, depending on the type of person, it's better done in a small group than it is on a man-to-man basis. Because you learn far more about quiet time, for example, when four or five guys are sitting around talking about it than you with him. Okay, how about division? Would you help a person without any long-range commitment on understanding or vision How about a person who wants to apply our vision but's not interested in doing it in our environment? Worthwhile investment?
We want to help people who are going into other mission boards or something like that. That's one of our goals, is to help people who won't necessarily be with Navigators. Mm-hmm.
His initial, often a person's initial mentality is that he just wants to develop whatever's necessary to do his thing somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But once he develops a vision, he sees that he likes to be around people with an identical vision.
Amen. Okay, now that's what we're going to take off on later on in the practical application of this stuff. How we burn people's bridges behind them. And this is part of the process of doing it. Okay, how about at the level of team and organization? What level of commitment or loyalty or authority would you want from a person?
I would think that if you have a team, that you're picking your own team, you'd have the right to have some type of standards. Because you have certain objectives and you're formulating a team to accomplish certain objectives, therefore you need a certain kind of man.
Okay, so now you're going to start making demands that are going to lift him out of his familiar environment and get him more closely related to the Navigator environment. Okay? And then we get down to the organization. Bam. Totally lifted out of any other environment and plunked into the Navigator environment exclusively. And then that person works out of the Navigator environment to make contributions where he can to other works. Yes?
So have you ever given any consideration to the individual relationship between the recruiter and the recruited fitting in somewhere in the first three?
Yes.
Possibly a step B or another step?
Relationships are basic to all five levels. That's why I don't have establishing a relationship as a part of the five levels. Those five levels are built on a foundation of relationships because recruiting is almost non-effective apart from a personal relationship. Now I'll get into more on that later on. I think personally that the amount of loyalty that we demand from people through these levels of recruiting is pretty much a reflection of our own personal insecurity. And that the more insecure a person is, the sooner he'll make a demand for commitment and loyalty before he will invest any of himself in a person. And from what I've seen, I'd say people who've been around the Navigators for quite a while are more prone to having a tight ship than those of us that are recent arrivals. A tightly knit run team where you have to ask for permission to do anything really turns me off. And if I came through the NAVs in that environment, I would never be here today. But I think our own security or insecurities pretty well dictate that level of commitment when we want it, rather than being able to objectively determine when we want that commitment. And the longer we can put off the commitment, the more accurate we're going to be when we finally recruit the guy. And I think many of us are so anxious to produce a person that we recruit people far too soon. And then we got the guy recruited, and then after he's around 2 or 3 years, we begin to see what we've recruited. And, you know, our heart sinks. Ugh. So then we take this guy, Tom old boy, And we pick him up and we try to stuff him back into the Christian community after we recruited him out of it 3 years before. Well, see, the problem is that during those 3 years, we've poisoned the well, so to speak, to the Christian community. And he can't make it with us, nor can he fit into the Christian community. We've spoiled it for him. And I'd say this is one of the major problems of recruiting. I'd like to illustrate it by two approaches to the ministry. And each of these that I'll illustrate are extremes. And I think most of us fit in the middle somewhere. I'm not saying one approach is any better than the other, but what I am saying is that each approach has its strengths and weaknesses in recruiting. And we need to be mindful of what they are so that we don't get ourselves caught in our own style of leadership or approach to the ministry. One approach to the ministry is where we come into an area and ignore the existing Christian community. The Christian community is a fragmented thing, I believe, and it's made up of segments. We have the Campus Crusade segment of the Christian community. Over here we've got the IV, and here we got the Officers Christian Fellowship. Here we got the Southern Baptist Church, and here we got the Presbyterians, and here we've got, well, it just goes on and on and on. The Navigator arrives on the scene. He views that Christian community and basically ignores it and starts his own ministry. He'll recruit from people at large. And more than likely dip one time or another into this thing, look the thing over and recruit people out of it. And build his own community. I intentionally left a space in here to illustrate that if he does not have an effective point of contact with the Christian community, then he's totally isolated from it. Now, we could move this line for many of us closer to the community and have two or three points of contact so that our community has a few points of contact with the existing Christian community, or draw it through a part of it. Now, looking at that approach to the ministry, what problems would you expect to have in recruiting people with that approach?
You create enemies in the Christian community.
Why would you create enemies there?
They become your foes because you've isolated yourself and you have a desire to do it.
Okay, by being isolated, what do we communicate? Exclusiveness. We don't need you. As a matter of fact, the only thing we do need you for is to baptize, marry, bury, and serve communion. Okay, well, if you want to really stretch it out there, visit the sick. Okay, we communicate this exclusiveness. What else? Oh, distrust. Good. How will that come about, Roy?
Well, as soon as they see you recruiting some of their key men, they're going to distrust you as far as, for one thing, they won't think that you really know who their key men are or what their strengths and weaknesses are. And they'll be afraid that you'll ruin their key. And then another distrust is that they'll think that all you want from them is their money and their leadership.
Yeah, but we say we're out to build leadership for the community.
Yeah, but we have to take 4 or 5 years sometimes to do that. They don't like
it. In the building of the leadership, we're looking for navigators to join the organization, too. I mean, that's part of the deal. hard for them to see the vision from our point of view. And I have problems with that too. And the people that are with me, I mean, in my team, have not come out from that bunch. Because those bunch there, they're wishy-washy and generally, shuffling their feet around.
Okay, it's my experience is just the opposite. The people that I have around that are future navigators, I've recruited out of here in their late 20s, early 30s, and out of the military officer corps, couples at age 25, 26, and 27. From a collegiate point of view. We're going to get onto that collegiate point of view in just a minute, because I think we've got some problems in even bothering to recruit out of the collegiate environment. And I say this because I don't believe that navigators are all that good at training leadership. And I would say that a guy has either had leadership training before he comes to the navigators, or he'll probably not make it, or have to pick it up with some outside involvement from the navigators. Guy that's been in the military for 4 or 5 years has had plenty of experience at leadership and has a great deal of training that the Army's given him. As a matter of fact, they've given him training aids to practice on, platoons, companies, and all the rest of it. And so the guy learns a tremendous amount about himself and about his capabilities of leading, and he learns all those principles from the military. A man who's had business experience, same thing. He learns how to make it in a dog-eat-dog world. And he learns what it is to be responsible. And our society is set up for such that the average college student doesn't have the opportunity to be responsible for much of anything. Well, let's press it right now, Ken. When we want to make a navigator, how old do we want this bird to be when we pin the title on him? I mean, what do you vision?
Kind of a contact point.
Okay, contact point. Yeah, contact point. Figuring it's going to take 3 years of contact point to become an area rep.
26, at least.
Contact point at 26.
I'd say probably as young as about 22.
22. Okay, let me push you a little bit there, Bob, okay? How much experience does a college graduate have at age 22 with real life?
Very
little. Very, very little. Now, let's assume that we've got out of our collegiate ministry a humdinger of a disciple maker. Okay? And he said, well, let's say he's a maker of disciple makers. 22 years old. What would you do with him? What would be good for him?
Get him a job. Get married.
Get a job. Get married.
Have children.
Move to another area.
Move to another area.
Send him to the Marines.
Send him to the Marines?
No, I would send him to the service.
Okay. Now see, Campus Crusade doesn't have the problem we have because their whole objective is different than ours. Their whole vision is different from ours. And this only makes sense in our environment. We are after a total man for 40 years. We want to make a permanent difference. Okay, and we want a guy who can go on a contact point and meet real needs in people's lives, not impart...
Right, and meet needs from experience.
That's the only way you can do it. I can minister to couples who have all sorts of problems in their relationship from one end of the spectrum to the other because I entered marriage as a pagan, flew the whole thing upside down, and in 3.5 years it turned right side up by the grace of God. And I know the processes I went through. So I'm in a position to help somebody. And I think we're a little reluctant to give that much responsibility to a 22-year-old because the guy has not had any real experience in life. So what would you say to this, Ken, in the collegiate environment, of taking this 22-year-old, and while he's in college, say, I want commitment from you for the next 2 years as a hardcore team member to make disciples with me on this campus. And at the end of that 2 years, the commitment is over. Finished. And then at the end of that, when the time college comes, you can tell this fella, now, how about getting out, getting a job to where you can apply what you've learned from the degree you've earned. Get off by yourself and just see what is a part of you because of your relationship with God and what's a part of you because of what has been pressured into you by being around this high-powered team environment. And just live life for the next 4 years. Find yourself a wife, support her, have a child, pay your monthly bills, get into any kind of ministry you want. Matter of fact, up in Abilene or Amarillo, there isn't anything up, there isn't any navigator up there. Why don't you go on up there and live? We'll talk to you on the telephone once a month. Write letters, bring you guys down to rallies or conferences that you're working with or whatever, and we'll just see what comes out of it. And then in the next 2, 3, or 4 years, the guy will have all kinds of experiences with life. His ship might start to go down one day, he calls you and you come up and you bail him out. And then you plant him back out there. And you see that this guy, man, what's he doing? Why, he's involved in this church and working with the kids out there and just having a blast. Well, you meet with him, talk with him, and he just develops this thing and it's great. He's fulfilled. Well, man, Tom, press on, baby, because that seems to be your calling of God. Would you recruit that guy back into the NAV environment? I wouldn't. But another guy gets out there, and he's making disciples. And he's relating to peers. It might come to a point where you just have to go pin a label on him because of the product of the ministry and what is demonstrated and what fulfills him. And while he's out there, he's not under pressure to produce any prototype of anything. If he wants to, fine. If he doesn't, fine. He's a giant success if anything comes out of it. Because he's related to God. I'm not saying that's what we ought to do, but I just want you to think about that. See, then after the guy's 26 years old, then we would go recruit him for training to be a navigator. One of the problems of this type of ministry is that usually after we take people out of there and bring them in here and require this big commitment, we got 10 guys and we go 2 or 3 years down the road and we discover one navigator in the whole bunch and we've got 9 to push back into this community. And by being around us and listening to the shop talk and all, he feels that singing in the choir, playing the guitar, singing in the choir. Yeah, it's I don't know if the UGG was for or against, but the guy feels that if he goes into the arts to make his contribution to disciple making, his life is a waste. And where did he get that from? From us. And so we say, well, what great opportunities out there, go out and do it. And he knows that he's lost, he's a loser. Because he knows where our values are, and he wants to please us. And we say, go out there and relate to it. And it's almost an impossible situation. Okay, so I say those are the problems that come out of that style of ministry. And we've got to seek to minimize those problems some way. And the thing that I have to offer in way of a concept is this, that we need to postpone the recruiting of people out of the environment that they're in until, well, as long as we can for the development of the man, so that when we pull him out, we're sure of that we want him at the level to which we recruit him.
Which level of recruiting is that? That would be to the organization?
No, to team or organization. It works the same. To team, I'd make it a temporary recruiting for the duration of this semester or this year at school. And it clearly understood, so that the guy doesn't think in the back of his mind, hey, I'm going to be a navigator someday. I know what they want, and I'll grunt it out. Because where we want it, we run into trouble because people conform to our practices on the surface of their life. And eventually, their inner man may align with their outward practice, conviction. Or it may be that he conforms for acceptance. He likes the relationships that we give him, but his inner man flows continually counter to what he's producing on the top. And the only way we can know in a healthy way is for that guy to get out and do his thing so that that inner man can be expressed, take the pressure off of conformity. The other way is to keep pressure on for more conformity until the guy splatters on the ceiling. He can't take it anymore. And then we say, oh, what happened to you? My inner self couldn't take it anymore. And so you have nervous breakdowns, you have suicides, and you have all this other kind of stuff because of, you know, outside pressures enforced on people. I think we hurt a lot of people doing that. I know I have. And it's all done under the name and with a clean, pure desire to help. And some we help and some we don't. Some we create miserable lives for. Okay, now the other approach to the ministry. Again, I'll draw the Christian community. The approach is the navigator arrives in the scene, sees the Christian community, and jumps right into it. He leads people to the Lord through it. He imparts, he helps people with lordship, imparts vision, and then out of it, some people will be attracted to him. Now, what would be the difficulties with this approach to a ministry? Could be, or if a person did come to you out of that environment, how would he have to come?
With a clean cut. For training.
With their blessing.
With their blessing. Yeah, amen. The elders come and they lay their hands on and send you out as a missionary from Umpty Dump Church to minister with this guy who is ministering within the whole Christian community at large. Now, does something come to your mind right away? What is the product of this ministry? Or what's the main thrust of this ministry as opposed to this ministry?
To the church.
Well, it's to the church, yes. But Sandy said in order for that ministry to be effective, it's got to produce what? Disciples. Okay, so I would say that this ministry's emphasis is primarily disciples. And it is closely identified with movement. Whereas this approach to the ministry has as its thrust what? Well, let me just say it's organization. Over here it's movement. And over here it's area reps. We want to produce leadership here. We want to produce disciples here. And by producing leadership, the fallout is going to be disciples. And by producing disciples, the fallout is going to be leadership. Oh, okay. The emphasis is clearly to produce disciples. And for it, there'll be 8 billion disciples, and maybe one guy would come out of that with the, you know, what we'd size up for a potential leader, because we're not out looking for that necessarily. We're out to impart vision and to get people to produce disciples. So the cutting edge of this ministry is disciple making, and a byproduct of this is going to be leadership. The leadership will take care of itself, so to speak. Over here, we're producing leadership to produce leadership to produce leadership. Now, right away, some things should fall into place in your mind as the problems with both approaches to ministry. Yeah, and this is probably the problem here, is because the person you recruit is going to reproduce this, isn't he? And the person you recruit out of that is going to reproduce that. And neither one of us are clearly satisfied with that or this, cut and dried. It wasn't what Scotty's message, that those of you that are doing this, if you can't do this 10 years from now, when the whistle is blown, you're going to find yourself on the unemployment list. I don't know if that's, you know, if he'd fess up to that, but that's what came across to me. You know that explosion that he talked about? Yeah, this is what's going to happen. Okay. Now let's talk about recruiting people to team. Level 4, and I'll just spend a few minutes on this and move on to the contact point level and to the navigator. I think one of the best places to go for instruction on recruiting to the team is a study of Christ's ministry in the Gospels. Christ had a 3-year ministry. And I think we can sum up the primary thrust of each of his 3 years. I think the first year of his ministry can be summed up with two words, exposure and attraction. The second year of his ministry can be summed up with the words recruiting and training. And the third year can be summed up with the words building and revelation. Now, if I've got it sorted out correctly, I'd say that it's probably took from October 26 to May 28, a period of about 18 to 19 months, before Christ formed his hardcore team. And we have that recorded in Mark 3, verses 13 through 19. And during the first year of Christ's ministry, he primarily joined the disciples in the ministry that they had. And what was the thrust of his preaching in that first year? Yeah, repent, the kingdom of God is at hand. And whose message was that? John the Baptist's. So he essentially joined in John the Baptist's ministry with John the Baptist's disciples. And it wasn't until John was beheaded that Christ recruited those people to his team. Up to that time, he didn't have the right to.
What about in John 1?
Yeah. Okay.
Is that where John maybe gave him a couple hundred or something?
No, they went off and followed him. And John, in John 1, 37 and 38, two of them heard him speak, and they followed after Christ. There are 4 or 5 disciples that came out of John's ministry there, in all probability. And they followed him, but it was still essentially John's ministry that Christ practiced. And the change didn't come until after John was beheaded. And then he selected, out of those disciples that followed him, 12. And I think the first year, the key to that whole first year was adequate exposure to recruit the right men. Okay, I'd like to give you some of the key principles out of the study of that first year.
What was the reference you gave us, Mark?
Mark 3, 13 through 19. The first key principle is this: personally select your own. These are people you are going to have to relate to. I made a discovery several years ago, much to my chagrin, that I was not God's gift to the body of Christ, and I couldn't effectively work with everybody. And that came as quite a shock. Now, some of you work towards Henner from the other end of the spectrum, having a somewhat high self-image that has been pounded on for the last few years. I was just really put down to make this discovery so that Tom here may be able to make this guy into a rational fanatic, but there's no way I could because Tom has different things to offer than I do. So select your own. And when you come and follow in another man's ministry, it usually takes a year to sort it out. Okay, secondly, and this is just a reflection of what Christ did. Keep the men in his natural surroundings doing their natural activities. Keep the men in their natural surroundings doing their natural activities. And this way you have a chance to observe them doing their thing. That brings us to another one. In recruiting, be your own cutting edge. Let's say that I have a ministry with three team leaders. Now, the three team leaders are probably not the stature of me. I can stay behind the three team leaders and push them out onto the campus, and they are going to do the selecting and recruiting, and people look at them and be attracted to them or not attracted to them. When the most attractive person is hiding in the bushes. So if you are your own cutting edge out there in the ministry, then you are going to attract the best that that team could attract. And so in recruiting, talked to a guy here, if you want to get to leadership, then go to where it's already been trained. You want to attract officers, and say you have you've been an officer, a college graduate, you can relate to these people, but yet your contact points around you have all been enlisted men, haven't been to college, and are doing a basic enlisted ministry. Well, to send that person out to try to attract this leadership type that you're after is frustrating him and may draw that person around, but he'll stay only for a short period of time. So you're just going to have to decide what you want and go get it. Suppose you were the only one that went out on a contact point. You didn't take anybody with you. From some of the experiences that I've had in past, I'd say that you'd probably be at an advantage to do that. But I would suggest that that person will probably put you a year behind in your ministry by giving you a team that he's recruited to go help you in many cases. Maybe not in all cases, but in some cases. To the point where I would really want to sort those people out because, you know, it might be another situation where these guys could work effectively for this other guy, but when he comes around me and my style, we don't have heart or anything together. So Christ, before he went, you know, he spent a couple of years getting this thing together.
Yeah. Well, you see, what I'm trying to think about is that really then it becomes a job of mine recruiting somebody else recruit. That's a work.
Yeah, it is. Then when you got them, you may not want them.
Are you speaking about going on a contact point alone as being the best for the man or the ministry?
See, it might be the best for both. Because the man who's got the most offer is the guy who's going out on the contact point. And if he is his own cutting edge, then the most attractive thing the Navigators has to offer that community is out there being exposed to it.
But then you're assuming that he's his own cutting edge in all the facets of the ministry, where he might be, he's a total man almost. He can preach, he can recruit, he leads the pace of evangelism, And
well, I think at the level, I think at the level of contact, the guy that goes out there needs to be gifted enough so that he can do the basic ministry. And I think as he gains altitude, then his shortcomings can be compensated by developing a staff around him, or a team developed that would make up for some of his shortcomings. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong to take a team out, but I'm saying it's not always the blessing that you would suppose it to be. And you may want to recruit from the area you go to. Okay? Methods of challenge. One is exposure of your life. This is principle. This is another principle, or the principles of challenge. And Christ exposed his life to these people, but he did it in the context of what they were doing. He was around them. He challenged them to what they could become. He told Peter, look, you're a little rock now. You've become a big rock. And apparently that turned old Peter on. Another method of challenge was to ask them to do something, to get involved. And the other method of challenge was to challenge their misconceptions. But I thought, no, this is it. He met their needs. Okay, three things before you recruit a guy at any level. Number one, be sure that the guy wants what you have. Number two, he's willing to pay any price to get it. And number three, he has what you want. He has what you want.
Is that at any level?
Well, down toward the team level.
So, Mike, what was the starting point? These are 3 points under what now?
Three things before you recruit a guy. Before you recruit him and have him around you in any kind of a defined relationship. And then lastly comes Matthew 4:19. Follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. Follow defines the relationship and the role. He's going to follow. Next, me. That means a personal involvement. Follow me. Next, I will make, that's you, I will make, that's the leader's job, and then fishers of men, the cause. Now that's basically the approach that I find in Christ's ministry. But one thing we've got to remember, Christ did this with mature men. In the collegiate ministry and a lot of the military ministries, we're working with young people. And some ministries have ended in real serious trouble because they've worked with these people as men and not boys, so to speak. So just think that over in your mind as you go through some of these things. Now, the navigators have put out a list over the years, well, this came about quite a few years ago, of things we'd look for in selecting a man for nav leadership. And this would apply at the team level as well as the navigator level. And I'd like to put these things up here for your consideration. Select men for nav leadership who Number one, our competitors. Now, this is getting into the area of what we're looking for. What kind of a guy are we looking for to recruit?
What level is this?
This would be down to team, hardcore, potential contact, contact point in there. Guys who are competitors. Fellows who are concept-oriented. Fellows who see opportunities rather than obstacles. Fellows who are self-starters. Who do more than they are asked. Who compare themselves with the ideal. And men who are desperate. Now, I'd say all of us in this room fall short in some of those things. Now, this, again, is somewhat of an ideal. But when we compromise with the ideal, we define the areas that we need to work in the guy's life. And we're risking that much in our recruiting that person. Okay, a guy who's a competitor, well, that's an achiever. Yeah?
How do you determine whether he's a competitor or just an ambitious person?
I'm not sure if you can. Until you've been around him for a while. But things are on the move in this guy's life.
And who is he competing with?
Oh, against the ideal.
Oh, the ideal.
What did you say about when we cut back on the ideal, that what happens?
Oh, if we see a fellow has three of these things and four of them are somewhat deficit, and we recruit him anyway, that's the degree to which you're gambling in recruiting that fellow.
That's the chance.
That's the chance element. And all of us take chances.
Part of being a competitor.
Yeah. I think so. And of course, the guy who's concept-oriented, there's a real premium on that. This guy can think through things. He's not going to come out of our system a trained gorilla who will go around and get people memorizing scripture on little cards and reproduce techniques only, but can understand the techniques as they relate to the concepts of what we're doing. Now, there's people who are more technically oriented than concept oriented. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not a guy we're going to give responsibility to. His involvement in our ministry will be limited. And as long as he's comfortable and you're comfortable having him on and around your team, fine. But recognize the limitation and make sure he knows the degree to which he's committed and that you're committed to him. Okay, and I think the rest of these things are somewhat self-explanatory, except maybe the last one, that the guy's desperate. This means that the guy wants to do what you're doing, and there isn't any place else that's going to satisfy him. He's hanging in there. He wants it. Okay, now when you look at people to determine if you want them or not, those are some of the things that should go through your mind. Now, in consideration for a navigator to recruit to that level, I think there are some things that we need to consider. Particularly in the area of gifts. Since we may have a guy who we really like, But when we begin to evaluate him along the gift line, he may come up real short. And to keep him in our environment and attempt to recruit him to be a navigator would only cause the guy a great amount of frustration, because there's no way he could be fulfilled in our environment. And so to recruit him would be to do him and us a great disservice. I think these are the gifts that are probably more related to our ministry than the others. And you may not call all these things gifts. The first is an ability in evangelism. Now, it's in Ephesians, and it's listed as an office. And it depends on how you interpret that, whether you call that a gift or not. Second is proficiency in teaching. Thirdly, administration. Fourthly, counseling. And two additional qualities that have been added to Lauren's list in the Southern Division: security, submission. No, those are qualities. I'll explain them in a minute. I think the area of gifts pretty well explains what we do. Now, this doesn't mean that a man needs to be extremely gifted in all four of those things, but maybe three of those things. And that he can develop a team of guys around him that would be gifted in the area that he's not, to make up for some of the things that he lacks. Okay? Now, these additional qualities, security and submission, we felt are pretty essential for a guy to be a navigator. And the reason for it is that if a guy is going to have a successful ministry where he is the focal point of it, then he needs security. And by that I mean he needs a pretty accurate image of himself to know what his strengths and weaknesses are and be able to cope with them, live with them, and do the ministry anyway without being threatened. He has a good family image, and he has a good community image, and he's secure in his family, and he's secure in his community. And then submission, because we all need to work and relate together, and the only way you can do it is to submit. Now, that takes a pretty peculiar breed of person. If a man is not secure, there's no way that he can serve. And if a man is not secure, there's no way he can submit. An insecure person cannot serve because he views it as being used and he rebels against it. And there's no way a man who's insecure can submit, because the submission for him comes out slavery. He will do, like Walt said, that person who will do whatever you ask without any convictions of his own. And we can't use those kinds of people.
Could you repeat that? An insecure person cannot serve because...
Okay, an insecure person cannot serve because he views it as being used. And he can't stand to be used. He's got to prove himself to be superior than the people around him. So to subordinate himself to someone to wash the floor, you know, is just beyond his capability. Or if he does it, inside he's burning. See, I could go wash any of your floors and be happy doing it. I'm not threatened by it. I don't have anything to prove to any of you or anybody else. You know, I'm secure. That would be the attitude that we're after. Okay, and again, to the degree those things are missing in a person that we recruit, that's the degree of chance that we take with the person. Now, in the remaining 15 minutes, what I'd like to do is to become practical with you now and get into some of the how-tos of applying these things that we've talked about so far. Okay, to be a recruiter. Number one, walk close to God. Because everything begins with the Lord. That's been preached to us this week several times. The better we know God, the better we know ourselves, and the better we know people. And the only way we get to know ourselves is as we focus in on the Lord and see Him and see ourselves contrasted to Him. And then all sorts of things come into perspective about self and about people. Okay, that's number one. Number two is prayer. Because where do people come from for us to work with in the first place? God gives them their gifts. Isaiah 45:14 talks about men of stature coming over to us. And they come from the Lord. So I think we need to be in prayer and ask God to bring us men of stature into our ministries. And He'll do it. Thirdly, to be a recruiter, do your ministry well. Wholeheartedly and totally committed. With that, you know, that unity of theory and practice. So that you do what you say. That's important to people. Now, when you do a ministry like this, you're going to scare off a lot of people. Okay, that's all right. We want a selective ministry. And if it's because of your proficiency and people are doing things well, great. But the kind of people that will attract are the people that we're after. Okay, the next thing is to get to know people. So we can take some of the chances out of recruiting. And a couple of things that have been helpful to me in this process have been reading Tim LaHaye's two books on temperament. One is Spirit Control Temperament and the other is Transformed Temperament. In LaHaye's book, he divides temperament into four main categories. And each of those categories have a peculiar set of strengths and weaknesses. Now, Jay Adams, who wrote Competent to Counsel, does not believe that Tim LaHaye is correct in his analysis of temperament. He didn't believe there's any such thing as four temperaments. Personally, I don't care if there is or not. It works. People generally fall into one of those four categories or not, and as I get to talk to a person for an hour or two and ask him some questions, I can pretty well identify where he is. And then a probable strengths and weaknesses come into my mind, then I can take questioning down those lines and pretty well know who I'm talking to, and if I become involved with that person, where the work is going to have to be done. Also, it tells me what approach to the ministry that person will probably take, because a person's temperament pretty well determines how he'll approach the ministry. Well, it's good, I think, to know that so that when you help a guy in a ministry, you help him develop along his bent and not make his ministry a carbon copy of your own. That's ridiculous because not everybody is like you. And for him to do it would frustrate him to death. So I think that is helpful. Then I went to Bill Gothard's thing on basic youth conflicts. Extremely helpful in getting to know people and identifying sin in people's lives. And then Competent to Counsel, Jay Adams, you know, an approach on how to deal with the whole thing. I think those three things have been very, very helpful to me in getting to know people and evaluating people to give me at least a starting point on where to minister to their real needs.
Is Jay Adams' book, Christian Life?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Competent to counsel. Yes, it's, boy, it's, we, y'all should read that book, because it's, you know, we've been exposed to the Rogerian and to the Freudian approach to counseling and to dealing in the, you know, the realm of psychology. And it's no good. It's not biblical. And this is.
J is J1.
Yes.
One thing those recognize is that there are, he calls them personality globs. And he doesn't limit the four or more. Probably what he does is he categorizes this and helps you to think more clearly about these things.
Yeah, Adams, I think, believes that that environment, that's pretty well determined by your experiences and whatnot. Where LaHaye's, I think, is more that's the way you're bent from the beginning.
Well, Adam says that too, that you're bent that way from the beginning. But if, say, your personality is, it has a potential, say, of either being patient as your environment develops that personality, or being stubborn. And when a person gets off on the stubborn end, that's where scriptural counseling is important. But he does agree that there are certain makeups in each individual that are characteristic of that person. You're not going to change that person, but he can be conformed to Christ with his makeup.
Well, then they do have a point of contact.
Yes.
I talked with him in Birmingham, Jay Adams, about this whole thing, and he was grinding an axe. Okay, number five, build relationships with a purpose. That's crucial to recruiting. I'd say that this is probably the most successful form of recruiting at any level. If you have a relationship with a pagan and share Christ with him, the probability of him receiving Christ is probably far greater just from man's perspective than cold turkey evangelism. Same thing with each of those four levels. If you've got a relationship with a guy, you generally have got the man. A person that you can enjoy socially is a person that will be effective with you in the ministry. A person you cannot enjoy socially or have anything in common with apart from spiritual activity probably in the long run won't go very far.
Go very far with you?
In the ministry.
Why is that? I mean, maybe, you know, Tom could minister to him socially, or, you know, isn't there a difference of personality here?
Yes, there is. And if you cannot relate to him socially, then it generally means that you're not meeting the man's total needs. Few people are satisfied with being related to on one level, the spiritual. And if you can't meet his emotional needs as well as spiritual, probably he won't stay around you. There are few of us who are so locked into the vision that we wouldn't care if a gorilla was training us. There are men like that. I happen to be one of them. But I haven't met many like me in that respect. But my initial attraction to the navigators wasn't because I saw gorillas, it was because I saw men. And in relationships, I think we have this pretty well, the importance of these things pretty well illustrated by the methods that the Communist Party uses in recruiting people. Here's another good book for you to read. A Dedication and Leadership by Hyde, H-Y-D-E. This guy was a member of the Communist Party for 20 years and was a Catholic convert. And then he writes this 200-page book describing the whole process that takes place in communist recruiting. And it's the applications are just, they just pour out of each chapter. And the way the communists operate and the way Christians work are just hand in glove. And he makes a statement in there that was really staggering to me. He says that people are recruited not because of doctrine. People are not recruited to the Communist Party because they understand dialectical materialism. But they're recruited because of relationships to people within the party and because of what they see those people do. Then they learn all this interpretation of the universe and the world and whatnot from the communist perspective. I think we can learn a lot from that one statement. Next in recruiting, look for the right time. 1 Timothy 5:22, don't lay hands too suddenly on people. 5:22. And the right time to recruit the guy is when he's desperate and his alternatives have been destroyed. And let me explain it, okay? Now, this is where I want to bring in a couple of examples of recruiting. And let me use the example of a military man, okay? And it would apply in the business realm, too. And if I have time, I'll go give you an example out of that, of people I've recruited. A captain and his wife in Fort Benning. I recruited a few years ago, and they're on their contact point now up in Alabama. This fella was led to the Lord by a navigator, Tom Einan. You know, this fellow who's now over in the
Taiwan,
part of the China Task Force. Okay, he was living in Columbus, Georgia at the time. Okay, now to what level is he recruited?
Salvation.
Okay, the guy, a very short period of time, 4 months later, is over in Vietnam for a year and his wife stays in Columbus. I met the guy for 10 minutes one evening before he went to Vietnam. So while I was in Vietnam, I started writing letters to him. Now, guys in Vietnam like to receive letters. So I kept up good correspondence with him, and his wife stayed in Columbus, and we helped her for the year that they were separated. He came back, and I got involved with him and helped him with lordship. Well, as Christ comes more to the center of that person's life, to what part of the world is he being spoiled? What does this do to his relationship to the average church if he lives a Christ-centered life?
Make him an oddball.
Yeah, doesn't it spoil him for the average church? Okay, so the bridge to the church, the average church, is burned. Okay, now we start imparting to this guy some of the navigator vision of multiplying disciples. It grabs a hold of him. Now what part of the Christian community can he effectively relate to and express himself in? All the navigators. Okay, bridges to the rest of the Christian community are burned. Now we get this guy down to level 4, involved in a ministry, and he's working 40, 50, 60 hours a week in the military. He's involved in a ministry with people. It becomes successful. He learns more and has more to give. And pretty soon, maybe 6 years into his career in the Army, the tension between occupation and doing that is unto the Lord and doing the ministry is unto the Lord becomes very real. And he sees that if he's going to give it what it takes to be successful as an Army major, he's going to have to back off from the ministry. But he didn't want to back off to the ministry because he likes that and enjoys it, and he's going to have to give that more time if that's going to grow and be successful, and he's going to have to back down off his occupation. So where is he?
Desperate.
He's desperate. He's hung. So he's got to make a decision. He says, okay, navigators, what's happened to the bridge to the occupation? Burned. Gaff him. He's got no place else to go. It's the most natural thing for him to do is to be with the navigators.
How long did it take?
With David, it didn't take that long with David. 3 years. With me, it took from 64 to 68, a little over 4 years. I did not want to leave the military and become a part of this thing because there are too many other people doing it. And I was afraid that I was going to do it because I was on the bandwagon. And God just almost had to shout in my ear before I'd leave the military. And he did. Roy?
Speaking of career and the navigator, it seems like the thing that we may do wrong with college students is that their area of study that they're supposed to be giving themselves to and developing their lives in becomes far less attractive than the fact that they are making disciples and developing disciple makers.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like we can fall into a trap there of really encouraging a man to give his all, you know, to the navigator thing and not watch his studies.
Then you ask him to get out and work in his major 3 or 4 years. That gives him frustration problems.
Yeah, if what you're saying is that we make too great a demand on people who are in college, I'd say, yes, we do. And oftentimes, to our chagrin later on, even though we've got 10 extra disciples roaring around the world, we're going to pay the fiddler sooner or later. And you know why we do that? Because our concept of what's spiritual is all messed up. Life is a spiritual exercise. Studying is a part of spirituality. And when we say to a guy, man, give it your all and get C's and D's, what we're saying is, well, do your studies not so much as unto the Lord as you do this. You know, it's not a clear-cut thing. You can't go one or the other. It's a balance. And I'm afraid that's the key life, or the key word to the Christian life, from my perspective, balance. We live in tension, and there's no way out of it. And a guy who is successful at living life is a guy who can cope with the tensions. And a guy who can't make it. So how much in the ministry? How much does he devote to studies? How much does a guy devote to his family? How much to the ministry? How much to his occupation? How much to, you know? It's different for everybody. But let's not spoil everybody, because we don't want everybody. Let's spoil those that we want. And how well can you evaluate a guy's gift when he graduates from college, his gifts? I don't think he can very well. It wasn't until I had an opportunity to have an audience that I discovered that I had the gift of working with groups, of teaching. You know, I had some ideas about it in college, but I didn't have anywhere to go practice it. So when I got into the Army and had to teach classes to my platoon, to my company, and then get assigned to the armor school to teach leadership there, I got an opportunity to check all this stuff out and to see if I had some abilities in these areas. Well, then somebody looking at me could make a real sound evaluation very accurately. And at the end, when we graduate from college, there's a lot of guesswork, I think, in there, because we don't know how that guy's going to respond with the responsibility of life and where he's going to blossom and where he's not going to blossom. And if we lay hands on him too early, you've got to accept the consequences. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about burning bridges, Gordy.
Mm-hmm.
You said with the captain that the bridge to the Christian community was burnt before the bridge to his occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a danger in other words, we don't want everybody to become navigators. If we let that bridge be burnt, That was the second one, I believe, that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
If that vision, that we wouldn't want to encourage that bridge to be burnt any more than just sharing the vision with them, not encouraging them in saying taboo to the rest of the Christians. It has to be his decision and none of our enthusiasm, but does it?
Yeah, I don't think I'd agree with that wholeheartedly, because the guy can effectively relate to the navigators and be a career military man and have a giant contribution within the framework of his occupation as an Army officer. And we want to destroy his option of relating to the local church at that level. See, because what are his choices? His choices are to minister with us or to minister with the church. Well, as long as he can see himself effectively ministering to the church and happy in it and fulfilled, we really don't have him. So the bridge as an opportunity, what I mean by burning bridges, I mean the opportunity or the attractiveness of that is gone. So he can relate to us his whole 20 years of career, have an effective ministry with us without ever becoming a navigator.
That's true for a military man, maybe, but for other people that we minister to, Bruce Carlson was telling me about a man who had navigator contact who is now with the Wycliffe Bible Translators.
Mm-hmm.
If that bridge had been burnt and the only way to go was the navigators, he's doing a very effective work with the Nav Vision, but in another organization.
Oh, okay. I see your caution.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say there that I would term that that his effective relationship is with the navigators, and that it would be for what we could do to help him, and at the same time what he'd contribute to us through his ministry. But at the same time, we'd want to communicate that what we are doing is only a small part of what God is doing in the world. And boy, we've got to communicate that. And in our enthusiasm of wanting to get people involved with this, we say a lot of things that are going to come out sin someday that we're going to have to account for. And we pay the consequence of that. Now this guy, with a proper attitude to the rest of the body, can see that the navigators are about as balanced as a flat tire. Now, I make no apology for it. I think we just need to recognize that that's the way life is, and that we have a very narrow band of ministry, be happy with it. But boy, when we see that, we can appreciate the rest of the body of Christ and what contribution they're making to the overall thing that God is doing in the world.
Okay, so you didn't want to recruit that fellow you were talking
okay.
about. Where would you change your tactics?
I would take him just as far as I wanted him. I wouldn't dangle anything in front of him I didn't want him to go after. I would, if I didn't want to recruit him to get onto the military, I wouldn't preach anything to him other than, present to him the whole picture of the elders in the New Testament, how they stayed in their community, maintained their occupation, and shepherded a local flock.
Okay, but you don't want to separate him from the local church then?
No. I do not.
Okay, so, but you would still share lordship with him, wouldn't you?
Yes, but see, his ministry...
The lordship might be separating him from the local church?
It may make the church program unattractive, but not the body.
Yeah, see, what it is going to do is that he's going to minister through the church, and he's not going to look to the church primarily as his major expression of ministry. He's going to look to the navigators as his major expression of ministry, and that's what we want. Because we want those people to look to us for leadership rather than the church during our training or our involvement with him. Now, the guy can effectively relate to a church and see that as for what it's doing and appreciate that, teach a Sunday school class in it, go to church on Sunday and whatnot, and relate to it okay. But we want him to see us as where his needs are really being met and his ministry to relate to what we're doing if he's going to be a part of our team effort. So we want to, I don't know if spoil it is the right word, but we want him to be more satisfied with us than the other. And just the natural process of working with a man will take care of it naturally. I think many of us are doing the right things. We just don't understand the implications of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Raising his standard, really.
Mm-hmm.
Lordship, we're getting his eyes not only on his own life, but on the product he sees in other people's life. Not to cut off his relationship with the church, but at least he's going to work in the church, make him his objective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's 20 minutes to 6, and I got a couple other things I'd like to say. Next thing in being a recruiter is that maintain objectivity in recruiting a man. Now, usually by this time, we've been around him 2 or 3 years, and we're very subjectively involved with the guy. And after we've been that long involved with the person, we, you know, we say, well, yeah, but. Well, I think at that point, you need to bring in the area representative from 100 miles down the road or your regional director or somebody to look at that guy and get an objective evaluation to help you determine how far to go with the guy. And don't be afraid to use some help in this area. And then once you want him, man, challenge him in giant ways. Make big demands. Sell your practice. Uproot onto the church. Move to Fort Worth. And we'll train you. Now, in closing, I'll say this. You get what you go after. Or it's said another way, you get what you are. Just like fishing. If you fish off the pier, you get perch and sunfish. And generally, in an afternoon, you can get a bushel. When you go after blue marlin, you may get one every 10 days, but when you got one, you got yourself some fish. If you want leadership and potential leadership, go where they are and fish in that pond. Otherwise, it's going to take you a long time to build it. One is not better than the other, it just is. I think the pipeline, the college freshman, to navigate a representative is about a 10 to 12 year process. I think you can shorten that by 5 to 6 years by fishing in a different pond for your potential leadership. You know, you can fish in the military officer, 25, 26-year-old married bracket, or you can fish in the business community. And recruit from there effectively and get the leadership. Okay, Roy?
Then you would say in a college ministry to recruit men from the business community to minister in the college ministry?
Yeah, I have a 32-year-old fella in Fort Worth that I'm working with to be a navigator who is more effective in the collegiate ministry than most of the younger people. I was kind of surprised to see it. It was kind of an experiment with me. And the thing of it was, you know, he's a young-minded, fun-loving kind of a guy. The kids see that he's older than they are, and they relate to him kind of as Papa, and in 2 hours, they spill the beans. You know, they see some young buck come up, they're in competition with him, and they maintain the facade, and everything's okay, baby. You know? And I'm just amazed at the effectiveness that this guy had. Oh, no, I believe that we can recruit and work with people in their late 20s and early 30s and make navigators out of them, and their overall contribution in the long run is going to be ministering in the business world community. But I believe that if the guy's got the right kind of leadership and managerial capabilities, that he can be an effective brigade leader, regional director, run an effective business community, and help tremendously guys that are running collegiate and military points. And I think we need to be working at leadership at all levels. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that I'm doing in Fort Worth.
In other words, you would pull a man into your ministry rather than, say, if he were involved in a church, going with him out on church visitation, you would take him over on the campus.
Oh, not the first 2 or 3 years. We worked with these people in first year with these two couples that we have in Fort Worth that I took with me from Columbus. They were worked within their own environment. They led Bible studies and made disciples through Bible studies, you know, like a normal church thing did. And they demonstrated themselves very well in that environment. And it wasn't until we marched with them a year and a half in their thing. And I kind of got things forced on me because I was told I was going to move. And so I went to them and said, I went to one couple and I said, I'm going to move to Fort Worth and I'd like you to consider moving with me.